Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who assesses the current famine crisis in Gaza and European nations planning to recognize a Palestinian state. Rebecca Gordon, a former professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco, who discusses the intention behind Trump's new surveillance state, examined in her recent article titled, How Will Your Data Be Deployed in an Age of Dark Enlightenment? And Kimberly Fountain of Americans for Financial Reform, who explains how a federal judge with backing from the Trump regime eliminated a Biden-era rule, removing medical debt from consumer credit reports. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In mid-July, Israeli airstrikes on the Syrian Defense Ministry in Damascus shook a divided Middle East as Israeli forces backed the minority Druze community in the southern city of Soweida. The latest fighting in Syria began with kidnappings and attacks between local Sunni Bedouin tribes and Druze armed factions in the south of the country. Syrian army forces that intervened to restore order also clashed with the Druze. Security forces reportedly carried out extrajudicial killings, looting, and burning civilian homes. Then the Israeli military intervened, creating more fractures. Syria's president, Ahmed al-Shara, the former head of al-Qaeda in Syria, who overthrew Bashar al-Assad's regime last December, condemned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for creating chaos in the region. A ceasefire took hold in Soweida, but Israel has taken an aggressive stance towards Syria's new leaders since Assad's fall. Israeli forces have seized a UN-patrolled buffer zone on Syrian territory along the Golan Heights border and launched hundreds of airstrikes on military sites inside Syria. During the Western Governors Association meeting in Santa Fe, New Mexico in late June, hundreds of protesters, many from hunting and outdoor recreation groups, gathered to oppose the proposed sale of federally owned public lands. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee had proposed an expansive sell-off of 3 million acres of public lands in Trump's big spending bill. Lee's effort eventually failed, but may lead to public land sales in western states, including Utah and Nevada, with support from right-wing groups like the American Enterprise Institute. Lee advocated for the sale of public lands as a way to address the nation's severe shortage of affordable housing. That idea won tacit support from East Coast liberals like columnist Ezra Klein and the New York Times editorial board. Yet ProPublica reports that there is little evidence to show that selling public land has led to the construction of affordable housing. Most housing developments today are built by contractors to appeal to wealthy buyers. Only in Nevada have new housing developments been kickstarted with a targeted discounted sale of small parcels of public land. Clark County, home to Las Vegas, bought 20 acres from the U.S. Bureau of Land Management for $2,000, with a plan to build single-family homes for first-time homebuyers. In the spring, a new development on formerly public land opened in Las Vegas for people 55 years old and up, with very affordable rents. New York City mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, won the Democratic Party primary, defeating disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo by 12 points. But the 33-year-old candidate, who was born in Uganda and raised in South Africa, lagged behind Cuomo in majority black precincts. However, Mamdani received strong support from African Americans under age 50. And according to polling for this November's general election, he leads among black voters in a four-way race with Cuomo, incumbent Mayor Eric Adams, and Republican Curtis Sliwa. In recent weeks, Mamdani's campaign has benefited from endorsements by major labor unions, including SEIU Locals District 1199 and 32BJ, who each have a large African-American membership. Black voters in New York City make up a quarter of the electorate and have been key to earlier victories of Mayors Bill de Blasio and Eric Adams. Mamdani, whose campaign has had wide appeal by focusing on making the city more affordable, lowering housing costs, and providing universal child care, is likely to become New York City's first Muslim South Asian socialist mayor. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The Israeli-engineered famine in Gaza continues to kill Palestinians on a daily basis. The United Nations reports that nearly 1,400 Palestinians have been shot and killed by Israeli soldiers as they've gathered to receive food and medical aid at four locations run by the U.S.-Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. As of August 5th, a total of 188 Palestinians have died of starvation and malnutrition, while Israel has only permitted 86 trucks carrying desperately needed food and humanitarian aid into Gaza per day, far short of the 600 trucks aid organizations say are needed to meet the basic needs of Gaza's 2.3 million people. This, as the Gaza Health Ministry reports, that more than 60,000 Palestinians have been killed in the war since the October 7, 2023 Hamas terrorist attack on Israel. Israeli media is reporting that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to announce plans for a full military occupation of the entire Gaza Strip, despite opposition from the Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff. Netanyahu's plan to escalate the war in Gaza comes as a group of 600 retired Israeli security officials, including former heads of the nation's intelligence agencies, have written a letter to U.S. President Donald Trump urging him to pressure Israel to end their war in Gaza. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who assesses the current famine crisis and ongoing violence in Gaza, and announcements by France, the United Kingdom, and Canada that they're considering plans to formally recognize a Palestinian state this September.
Anyone who has seen aerial pictures of the Gaza Strip basically sees a post-apocalyptic landscape. For me, I think it looks worse than parts of Hiroshima and Dresden after the Second World War. It looks like a landscape of ash. Building after building has been bombed, blasted to the ground. It's rubble. The agricultural land has been destroyed. Essentially, the Israelis already control 86.1% of the Gaza Strip. That's most of Gaza, obviously, and the population, the 2 million Palestinians who live there, have been mostly forced into al-Mawasi, a so-called safe zone on the west coast of the Gaza Strip, bordering the sea, and are living in tents in a new kind of, I can't find the right words to describe it. It's a horrible situation. You've got hundreds of thousands of people. They don't have adequate food, if at all. And we're talking about one in three Gazans now risking severe malnutrition. Almost 200 people have now died of malnutrition, starvation in Gaza. I think 87 or so of them have been children. They have no medications to give people who get sick, no way of infusing them with liquids and glucose, this kind of thing that at least rehydrates the body. It's really hard to find the words to describe what's happening there today. Clearly, the Israelis want the Gazan population out of Gaza. There will be a push to get the people in the north south. That's the first step because Israel plans to retake the northern half of the Gaza Strip up to the Netzarim corridor. So eventually that will be gone. And it doesn't surprise me at all to read that Netanyahu is now going to seek to retake all of the Gaza Strip. I think personally this was long in his plan. I can't prove that, but anybody who has been following the negotiations for a ceasefire will recognize that even when Hamas has accepted all of the conditions of the ceasefire agreement, such as they did last fall, Netanyahu then finds a way to throw a wrench in it and say it's not sufficient. So Hamas gets blamed every time they say no ceasefire was agreed, and they say that it's demanding things that are unreasonable, such as what? Such as a permanent ceasefire, a permanent end to the war.
Thank you for that, Jennifer. France, Canada, and the United Kingdom have both announced recently that they're considering formally recognizing a Palestinian state, maybe this September at the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York. I wondered if you would comment on what, if any, difference a recognition of a Palestinian state by these important European powers could make in the trajectory of this horrendous conflict, as well as ending this war that has claimed so many Palestinian lives.
I don't think that it is insignificant that France and Canada have and other states have said that they will recognize a Palestinian state this September. For the UK, it's based on some conditions that I have issues with, but that's a different story. It's not insignificant that they're doing this. I think what it does is signal to Israel that these powers are fed up, that they've had enough. They don't see where this is going. They don't see it ending. They don't understand how much what is left in Gaza to destroy. So I think there is a sense in the international community and certainly among these nations that enough is enough. But at the same time, declaring a Palestinian state is the very least they can do. I mean, I can't tell you how much happier I would be if these states basically said we're going to sanction Israel, said we're no longer going to trade with Israel, we're no longer going to sell Israel weapons, we're no longer just going to have business as usual, as in real time we are seeing babies rib cages because they don't have any food in their bodies. I mean, this is just, you know, the sadism involved in doing that to an entire people and to seeing the smallest and the most vulnerable people suffer in this way. So to say, yes, we're going to recognize Palestine this September, that's all fine and good. Whether a Palestine will ever come into the picture, none of us really know. But it's not stopping this calamity. It's not putting an end to the incredible suffering that people are experiencing day in and day out.
That was Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Find more analysis and commentary on Israel's ongoing war in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. An executive order issued by President Trump in March signaled the administration's intent to bypass existing federal privacy safeguards. The order forced states to hand over their own sensitive data sets and transfer protected statistical information to Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, giving this unaccountable Trump-created entity unrestricted access to nearly every American's sensitive personal information. The executive order was presented as an initiative to rein in waste, fraud, and abuse by eliminating information silos. But for decades, federal government databases have been deliberately separated and placed into individual silos in order to make it more difficult for bad actors to gain unfettered access to steal or abuse sensitive personal information, and thereby limit potential damage. Labor unions and the advocacy group Democracy Forward filed a lawsuit to block DOGE from accessing millions of Americans' confidential Social Security information, but in June, the extremist right-wing Supreme Court majority temporarily overturned actions by two lower courts, granting DOGE access to the data. Your reporter spoke with Rebecca Gordon, a semi-retired professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco, author, and longtime political and faculty union activist. Here she discusses the intention behind Trump's new surveillance state, examined in her recent article titled, How Will Your Data Be Deployed in an Age of Dark Enlightenment?
This is an executive order that came out in March, and it was actually called the Stopping Waste, Fraud, and Abuse by Eliminating Information Silos Executive Order. What eliminating information silos really means is combining information from the many sensitive databases that the government, the federal government, maintains. And two of the most important of these, of course, are all of the information that the IRS has about our financial situations, including everything from our bank accounts to our sources of income to where we've lived for the last 30 years, with information from the Social Security Administration, which also includes information from Medicare and so in that sense, health information as well. This is something that was one of the main purposes of DOGE. To a certain extent, although there was a lot of theater and a lot of terrible destruction of all of the instruments of government by the attacks on the federal workforce and so forth and, you know, entire agencies. But another key goal that was not really trumpeted, so to speak, so loudly, was this one of really increasing the capacity for surveillance on people in this country at a grossly detailed level. And to do that, they are hiring a company named Palantir. And Palantir is a security company that has also worked for the Israel Defense Force and the Israeli government and has its fingers pretty much everywhere, including in the Pentagon. They've just received a huge contract at the Pentagon for $750 million. But their goal is to do the technical work of combining these databases into one big, beautiful database. And they already have access to all of the data. It's too late to stop this. It's already happening.
Tell us about the role of Elon Musk, DOGE, as well as Peter Thiel, the corporate head of Planeteer, who's also an investor, as you say in the article, of Clearview, which deals in facial recognition technology.
So Elon Musk, who brought in the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is one of a set of Silicon Valley-based technology mavens who are all part of, you know, I don't want to go so far as to say a cabal, but they are a group of people who are adherents of a certain philosophical viewpoint. And this becomes important because they have enough money to actually attempt to impose their particular philosophy on the entire country. And this is the idea that is sometimes called neo-reactionary movement or the dark enlightenment. And there are different flavors of this, but the essential idea is that democracy has run its course. Democracy is a failed experiment. All of the ideas of the European 17th and 18th century enlightenment, things like democratic rule, that governments derive their power from the just consent of the governed, which is in our Declaration of Independence, the idea of human equality, all of that was wrong, is a failed experiment. And what we really need are small, monarchical, essentially corporate-run nationlets that are part of a whole network of nations, all run by autocratic, monarchical, if not necessarily dynastic, rulers.
Well, Rebecca, we're almost out of time. A last point I'd like you to make is that you conclude your article by asking the question, how should we respond to this new high-tech surveillance state, which really violates our privacy and has hold of all of our sensitive information?
What I think and what I've always thought is that the only answer to knowing that you are under surveillance is to live as openly and freely as you possibly can. And yes, that means you put yourself at risk. But if you don't live openly, if you don't take risk, then they've already won. They've already succeeded in doing what the purpose of this is, which is to constrain resistance. The only answer to mass surveillance is mass defiance.
That was Rebecca Gordon, a semi-retired professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco and author of the books Mainstreaming Torture and America Nuremberg. Find a link to her article titled How Will Your Data Be Deployed in an Age of Dark Enlightenment and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Medical debt is the biggest cause of personal bankruptcy in the U.S., where 100 million Americans owe a collective $220 billion in medical debt. Many people across the country applauded the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's decision last year to remove medical debt from individuals' credit scores. The rule was finalized on January 7th, but several credit rating agencies immediately sued to stop it. Then on April 30th, the CFPB, now under Trump administration control, asked a federal court to vacate the agency's own rule. Support for the CFPB's rule crosses political lines, with 85% of Democrats, 77% of Republicans, and 72% of independents in favor of government policy that removes medical debt from credit reports. More than a dozen states responding to the rule's popularity have passed their own legislation excluding medical debt from their residents' credit scores. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kimberly Fountain, consumer financial justice field manager with the group Americans for Financial Reform. Here she explains why medical debt shouldn't be included in consumers' credit ratings and the disparate impact it has on different communities.
So before there was a medical debt rule created by the CFPB, any kind of medical debt that you had could be on your credit report. Before then, and now, with medical debt being on your credit report, it can prevent you from getting an affordable APR rate on a credit card. It can prevent you from getting a mortgage. It could prevent you from getting rental housing. Credit scores are a big part of our economic system. But what's interesting is when it comes to medical debt, it's not something that people plan for. You don't plan to get sick or injured. Studies have shown that it's not an accurate predictor of whether someone will repay loan payments. And then on top of that, there's also various studies and reports, indications that a lot of medical debt is actually inaccurate. So people sometimes feel pressured to pay off debts that aren't even accurate debts or have already actually been paid off. More than 100 million people have medical debt, and it does show up on the credit reports of 15 million people. It also impacts some communities more than others. Black and Latina households are more likely to carry medical debt than white households. Adults with a disability are more than twice as likely to report medical debt. And then new mothers are more than twice as likely to have a medical debt as young women who did not give birth.
This change that the Biden administration made, that was through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Yes. With any regulation that, you know, a government agency does, there was first a request for information on just medical debt in general. There was comment periods for when the proposed rule came out. Industry advocates, the American people, everyone was able to make comments during the comment period for this to be approved. Unfortunately, the medical debt rule never ended up, while it was finalized, it was under lawsuit, so it was never implemented, unfortunately. It was two industry groups that filed it. Those industry groups were the Consumer Data Industry Association and the Cornerstone League. Shortly, you know, after this rule was finalized, this lawsuit came up by these two industry players suing to block the rule and arguing that the Bureau had exceeded its authority. And this lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas, which is basically court shopping. It was a popular venue for litigation challenging the federal government's reach. In April, the Trump administration's bureau joined those trade groups that had already filed the lawsuit and asking for the federal court to strike down the agency's regulation.
Congress has the ability to basically strike down any law that was finalized within 100 days of the change in administrations.
This did not get overturned by Congress. I believe that the reason it didn't get overturned by Congress is because this rule is very popular. A federal judge blocked the rule intended to make it easier for Americans to get loans by removing medical debt off their credit reports. And that was really recently, maybe just a couple weeks ago. I do know that many states are passing their own laws around this because it's just impacting so many people.
And so if states pass their laws, people who live in those states then could have the medical debt removed from the credit reports?
So I know for a fact that New York has a medical debt rule. Let's say you're moving from a state that doesn't have a medical debt law on the books. Your debt from that previous state is still not going to be removed. A rule like this is actually going to impact everyone in a positive way versus having it just a state-by-state thing.
That was Kimberly Fountain, Consumer Financial Justice Field Manager with the group Americans for Financial Reform. Learn more about medical debt, bankruptcy, and credit scores by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.